I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Remind me again how you did what you've done to your leg.
Oh, hockey.
Hockey.
Ice hockey, yeah.
Ice hockey. I love it. So your background, before we get into any of the music stuff and the documentary filmmaking, your background was extreme sport video making, right?
Yeah, I did a lot of, I sort of cut my teeth doing like Super 8 films, actually. I lived in Mammoth at the time, which was a ski resort.
Yep.
Up in Northern California. So I was shooting a lot of the mountain activity, and then my father lived down here by the beach. So skating, surfing, skiing, and then that ultimately yielded into snowboarding too. So.
And is it Warren Miller, who was a guy you were working with?
I was in a couple films. Like, he came and shot two separate times. He did a ski film with a team that was going to Europe for the International Student Ski Championships. And so he shot us. And I did another film after that just about Mammoth, where I was skateboarding. But when the first time he came out, we're just a whole bunch of kids that are skiing down the mountain. And there's this old dude who's just working all alone, carrying a wooden tripod on his shoulders, skiing.
Wooden. Wow.
Yeah, it was old school. and he'd, stop, set the camera down, scope things out, and say, all right, kids, let's go. And then we'd ski down and just do different shots with him. And I was like, man, that guy's got a cool job. So I was young. I was in junior high at that point, freshman in high school. So, which is probably around 13, 14 years old. And then it just sort of planted the seed, and I hijacked a camera that my parents had given us kids. I have a brother and sister, and just started shooting films like that, basically, but Super 8, and patching them together, on this really crappy editing system. And
what were you using back then? What would it have been?
Well, the editing was just honestly, just a cut and paste, razor blade and tape. And the cameras that I've worked with all a lot, but a Yashica Super 8 camera, which was just, really down market model.
Cumbersome.
But, yeah. And just, really terrible lens. But it was fun, I didn't have any, it was just cool to do. It was just sort of like, all right, well, this is going to be essential to my life as eating and breathing. So,
That was it. You got bitten by the bug, did you?
Yeah.
Was it everything as well? Was it the filming and the editing? Was it the whole process?
At that point, it really was just the filming, because editing was such a pain.
Yeah.
But and then seeing the results, and I guess piecing things together. But it wasn't very creative. It was just like you. And action sports is, even today, mostly, you're documenting the progression of a sport.
Yeah.
Right. So you don't. Obviously, that it takes a lot of effort and skill to put yourself in places to get certain shots, but in terms of creatively, they're not all that challenging, in terms of narrative or anything like that. You're pretty much putting shots end to end and
just capturing the tricks.
Yeah, and then later on after you know a certain period of music videos, I came back to that world and tried to mess with the structure and the real fabric of those films and try to shake up that sort of basic structure to what that culture really demanded. And it's funny just the reaction to that, because it was like, you know, we were doing all these editing tricks and cutting things in ways that that culture hadn't necessarily seen or seen a lot. And because it was all sort of experimental film ethos pasted onto an action sports subject matter. So it was funny to see the reaction to that. I did a film for Quicksilver and surf culture is sleepy, you know, and it's like, it can be sort of complacent creatively. There's a lot of really beautiful work and really beautiful photography, but I think in terms of, you know, being out front of a creative endeavor, you know, it's like it's never really in the structure or the substance of the tactile nature of film. And so, but I still kept working in that world and working with, you know, different brands, skate brands, surf brands, snowboard brands, I mean, it's great. It's a great sandbox to play in, you know.
Have you always kind of had one foot in music and one foot in the sport world? Is that how your career has been characterized, would you say?
Yeah, I think sport, because I sort of grew up as an athlete and, you know, did all the idiot things that
like hurt your leg.
Yeah. and so, but the physicality of that world was something that was really, sports were more important than school to me, you know, and every season had a different, sort of a different drug, I guess, with what sport you did. Cause you moved at that. Now kids sort of focus on one sport year round. But when I grew up, it really was like you moved around a lot
and you would snowboard in the winter, mm-hmm. surf in the summer,
yeah.
skate in spring.
Yeah, or you surfed year round for sure. Yeah. But also even in terms of traditional sports like baseball, soccer, what that world or that history, I guess, afforded me was, it just really informed actually the way that I approached subjects, you know, and to try to bring that sort of physicality to how I operated a camera or how I or the effects that I wanted an edit to have, you know, and just in terms of the visceral quality and the kinetic nature of sport, I find those elements obviously in music. I mean, they're super present, right? So
yeah.
It's just a matter of like, so you know, whether it's the subject you choose or you know, how you want to move the camera or create an edit, you know, that bringing that same sort of kinetic quality to music, I think it's a, you know, it's sort of a natural fit.
Even early on, like the couple of early Soundgarden videos that you did, there's a real fluidity to the camera movement, and you've got sort of all the musicians crawling over that space. In, is it Loud Love was the mm-hmm. video you did?
And Hands All Over. Yeah.
And Hands All Over, yeah. And both of those videos have that similar kind of like, you feel like you're in the groove with the band, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that was sort of like, but it's funny, both those videos are sort of like, you know, monkeys in the jungle gym. And Chris especially, he's very athletic, you know, so not everybody can do that stuff. It's funny too, because like when I just started, because I'm re-digitizing a lot of that stuff, so it's, you know, in the higher def, and so I'm finding a lot of those old videos, and I look at those like, what the fuck was I doing? You know, but it was fun, you know. It was like, especially at that point in time, it was just sort of like, you know,
making it up, right?
Well, yeah, and also those, like that, those genres of music, they really were sort of like, that was the lunatic part of the music industry, you know? It's like, and they, it was like, we had our own asylum, so to speak. So yeah, there was that sort of, you know, wild erraticness. I mean, it was even literally like in Come As, Nirvana's Come As You Are, it's like literally swinging from the chandeliers. You know?
Yeah. So, and was that their idea or yours?
No, it was mine.
That was yours.
Yeah.
He sat on it at one scene, isn't he? Just swinging, and then later on, he is literally hanging from it, swinging across the room.
Yeah. So
you've been around some amazing people, Kevin. Did it all begin with the triple-headed Sonic Youth sort of experimentation? You made a feature film with Kim Gordon, right? And then you used some of the footage from that to make a music video and sort of sent it in to MTV. Is that how the story goes? And
yeah, she had, Sonic Youth has a, you know, a lot of times their music is, you know, much more,
it's so cerebral,
rocky, right?
Isn't
but
it?
This, there's the song that we used in the film was one of her speak sing, song Shadow of a Doubt. So, and there's a point where this, she was sitting on top of a train and sort of spinning around in a circle while the camera was also spinning in another direction, basically. So when the train went into a tunnel, there was like 10 or 15 seconds of black, and the band saw it and was like, that's the perfect place to put the band's performance. And then when it came back out of the tunnel, everybody was gone. Kim was gone. The band was gone. And I really didn't know like music videos at that point, like just how my setup at home was way more into film. So I know that music video had started, you know, had started with a lot of the big hair bands, and so it didn't really, elicit that much interest for me. And then once I saw You Can, like it, cause that video took off, and a company pulled me in and said, hey, we want you to do music videos for us. And then I started working with a lot of bands that were of similar ilk, you know, whether it's Mazzy Star or Opal or
Fade Into You, man. That video, I mean, that song is so beautiful, and what a beautiful voice.
Yeah, she's
but that video
gorgeous.
Is magic.
Yeah,
dreamy desert landscape, like just the perfect marriage of visual and sound.
Thanks. And that was the second video actually I did for them. The first one was just like, oh, we got like $800. Let's go shoot something, you know. Like our inspiration actually I think was really more like Don't Look Back, you know, the Bob Dylan thing. And just doing something super psychedelic. So if you have enough of those experiences where like you can shoot whatever you want, edit it however you want, kick it out, and all of a sudden it's like it makes a little splash, it's like, wow, this is sort of cool, you know. It's like and even on MTV, like the fact that it sort of found a little corner in that universe.
Yeah.
I was like, there's something to, you know, that was a point in time that they don't come around all that often. Right. And I was just lucky to have been there, and also, to be tagged by, you know, some of these bands that saw, you know, a kindred spirit. And so, yeah, it was super fun. And none of the record executives at that point really came to the set. You know, they were like, well, a lot of them were on indie labels. So, you know, they were sort of overstretched in terms of their.
So you were essentially given free rein, were you, in a lot of instances?
And even in the beginning, the bigger labels, those bands had sort of, they had to do a video. It was contractually obligated for the label to step up, but because they didn't really mean that much to the labels.
Yeah.
Like a lot of the executives didn't show up, you know, so we could just do whatever we wanted. And I mean, ultimately once the underground, like alt rock and indie rock started to,
cross over.
Yeah. Then people straightened up and they wanted to start formalizing, you know, they paid a lot more attention at that point. And sometimes there are great people in that world who added a lot and really protected the what was special about indie rock and the music videos at that point, and really helped evolve it. And then there were, of course, like, you know, your standard music execs who went in the wrong direction.
Yeah. And really just wanted to turn it into a factory assembly line.
Yeah.
To print money.
Yeah.
Right. Did it feel like you were creating a new language? Did it feel like you were sort of inventing a new subgenre, if you will?
Yeah, it's funny you say that. It actually felt like more of an extension of different film cultures.
Yeah.
in the past, who for me personally was experimental film, or even, you know, even aspects of more traditional filmmaking, but more filmmakers that had their own identity, you know, auteurs that inspired me, right? And not that we were necessarily, you know, doing work that was equal to them, just more that we're you know, it shared a lot of that DNA and as an inspiration. So it's funny, it didn't feel like it was totally new. I think when you look back, it's like it definitely had it had an impact on so many other aspects of filmmaking, commercials for sure, even narrative filmmaking, film and television, that the kineticism that you saw in music videos, I think started to inform some of the other formats. And I mean, yeah, it was like, there was something very special about MTV, but it didn't feel like it was like, you know, we invented the wheel.
I think as much as anything, it was the bands, wasn't it? The bands of that era were so special. And it's only really now, I think, that you can look back and see. I mean, there's bands like, say, Primus. I mean, let's talk about them. Just a filmmaker's dream, right, to work with a band like that, that are so obscure and strange and, like, inspirational. If you're trying to come up with a visual motif to accompany a song like, which was the song you did with Primus?
Too Many Puppies.
Too Many Puppies.
Yeah.
And you've got that weird, like, Caliban-type character running around in his pants. obviously just mixed with sort of like a live show, was it? Was it just like a gig you filmed and then mixed in with a bit of that? I mean, bands like that must have been a joy and a dream to work with, because they were just so original and distinct.
Yeah, and also at the same time, not very precious about, you know, making sure that you know, you're putting out the right message, and you're like, I guess some of it has to do with, you know, there's this sort of term that you got to be free to fail, when you get in a rehearsal studio or you're collaborating with anybody, it's like, you know, just having that, we just want to do stuff and we can riff and be spontaneous and also curate, you know, something that's you know, not just, you know, just off the cuff. But I think that you know, not getting so precious about being perfect every time, and I think that's the spirit of indie rock. But you're right, like that era of music, there were so many amazing bands,
so many.
They were so doing
all so different as well.
Yeah, and that really is the thing that. That was the juice that I think any music video director sort of ran on, and so, you know, and to be able to take that as a cue, and to have the follow through, yeah, they're gonna do 12 songs on an album, right, or what, or even more, and they may do one video, but to still bring that same experimentation to the visual world, you know, that takes it takes some balls. and also I just a faith, actually, and you know, everything will be all right, and you know, you can play, you don't have to be, you have to fold every corner, you know, perfectly. And that's the problem, obviously, with once you get into the once the risk reward really factors into a commercial band or a commercial endeavor. And everything ultimately ended up being a commercial endeavor because...
We got the police going above us, have we?
That's the...
There we go.
Yeah.
The LAPD. Carry on.
That's our state bird. But the formality of that and the faith that, you know, you can make some mistakes, you know, and even in the fabric of the image, like I used to experiment with you know, ripping apart the emulsion on film or developing it in my bathtub. You know, those are all things like that were done in experimental film, you know, in the years past.
But certainly not for like Motley Crue videos or Def Leppard.
Yeah. Yeah. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Yeah. You're talking about you may rip half the image that you just shot away, or you actually may even destroy it. Like, no way. And you know, this is a business. This is a, you know, an enterprise.
Yeah.
And so it pivoted. You know, yeah, and you learn to work with it, of course, but and try to sneak in those things when you can, but and occasionally somebody will say, yeah, let's take those chances.
There's so many videos I want to talk to you about. I obviously don't just want to go through one by one because that might be a bit boring for you, but for me, having watched almost all the music videos you've made over the course of your career over the last few days and the lead up to this chat to try and soak in and absorb your visual style and the development of that visual style. For me, like your first masterpiece video, if I could be so bold, is the Travolta video for Mr. Bungle. Like that is, because before that you'd obviously done the Sonic Youth ones. Had the whole one come before that as well, Garbage Man?
Yeah, I think so.
Primus and Soundgarden, and then you get to that video, and it's carnivalesque, and it, again, I mean, the source material is the song, right? And that's the inspiration to go to all those places. Tell me about your memories from recording and editing as well, that insane piece of work.
Yeah, it's funny. The Mr. Bungle was... So Mike Patton was the lead singer of Mr. Bungle, he was also the lead singer of Faith No More at the time. So I just finished Midlife Crisis, I think.
Oh, that preceded it, did it?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Okay, got you.
And I believe so.
Well, that's a masterpiece too. I thought that might have been afterwards. But yeah.
But and Patton's just a total genius in the craziest way. And I think that you know, with Bungle, just especially lyrically. And all, you know, it's really dark,
yeah,
and carnivalesque, and you know, even just, I think the first lyrics are "All behold the spectacle, the fleshy limbless rectangle," which is about a double amputee, and that's just like that image is so shockingly precise, and just the lyric, you know, and it's
even like a line like "your menstruating heart,"
yeah,
like it's graphic, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's...
yeah. So he has a special knack for doing that.
The grotesque. So,
and the idea was just to go up, just doing everything in the kitchen sink approach, you know, and then just throw it at the wall and putting it together. That's sort of a madness in its own, but we were hanging people from hooks, you know, severed heads throughout the whole thing with bugs crawling on them. And
would that be getting played at sort of like peak hour?
You know, it's
or was
funny,
it a late night video? That
well,
one?
So at that point in time, the MTV had a Sunday night show called 120 Minutes.
Yeah,
and that really was the form that most of the videos that I did. Showed up. I don't even know if they would entertain the idea of showing Mr. Bungle. Like, I think a lot of people even like didn't know that it even existed. But like when I put it up on YouTube and it's really funny. The I don't get that video gets more comments than anything.
Does it?
Yeah.
Because it's so provocative.
Yeah, and yeah, I just felt like it found a perfect sync point, to be honest, with the lyrics. You know, it was like my job at that point was like, all right, I got to step up here, you know, and do something that has that same sort of visceral effect that Patton's lyrics and also sonically, that band, they just do these abrupt. It's a sort of like a jazz punk band.
Yeah,
you know? They have those sort of.
Lots of left turns all of a sudden.
And they're all amazing players.
Yeah.
Right. And that's the thing about like that type of music, and even sometimes even metal. It's like they're all virtuosos, you know, in a way. So it's this really funny dynamic between, you know, super sophisticated and accomplished, and on the other side, something that's completely out of its mind.
Yeah, yeah. And raw, yeah. And nasty, and yeah. Underground. I mean, Faith No More as well, particularly at that point in time. What an unstoppable unit. How did you meet those guys? Were you telling me, did you go to school or something, or grew up?
So it's funny, Roddy Bottom and Billy Gould, their fathers went to school with my... Their fathers and mothers, actually, went to school with my parents. And so we knew each other since, like, we were... you know, little baby tots.
Right.
And they were both younger than I was. So they were more friends. Roddy and Billy were more friends with my brother. But we were around each other all the time just because of our parents, right? They remain really good friends. So, and I was just a fan of Faith No More, you know, throughout the years. And I think also we probably both felt like it'd be weird for us to do work with each other just because we know each other so well. So it just feels like I didn't push it. They didn't push it.
But and we almost had to go and do a few other things first probably, to try and find your voice and your feet.
Yeah. So, and plus they were living in San Francisco, the Bay Area. So we hadn't spent much time together. Anyway, we, you know, the lines converged again and it was time for Midlife Crisis. So I was like, yeah, fuck yeah. I love that song. And I love them just personally, but also as a band. And so the funny thing also is that our parents, we came out of, they went to Catholic school. All generations did, their parents and them. So we have a funny... experience with the, you know, altar boys and Catholic boys and all that. So that imagery was like almost just instantaneous. It's like, okay, you got to play in that world, right? And then I don't even know how I came up with the you know, quartered by horses, but it was just something that just sort of stuck. And the question then was just, all right, well, how do you pull that off? So
and was that tricky? Are you working with animals tricky. For the first time there?
No, I work with horses a bit, but more solo.
Right.
And when you put four horses in facing opposite directions, mm-hmm. that's not their nature, you know. So and their instinct is that they're pack animals, so they all sort of want to go in the same direction. So when and we're shooting above this, with him below, the stuntman was on a metal or marble plate in the middle of a quartering situation, and then we just gave the cue, and one horse reared up at the same time that the horse opposite it pulled forward, so it basically was pulling the horse back on its back, and just about to land on the stuntman. Right, and I'm looking at all this from above. It's like, oh shit, this is like not good. But the stuntman was so agile that he slipped off the marble plate and got out of there. No, and no horses were hurt, thank God. And then we did a different variation on that just to get coverage. You know?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
We could put the sequence together but yeah, that was tricky.
Did you meet Courtney before she was with Kurt when you did that whole video? Because she's old friends with Roddy as well, right? Mm-hmm. Or are you indeed old friends with her?
Yeah, I met Courtney through Roddy.
Right.
Roddy. And I sort of run...
Did she audition to be in Faith No More or something? To be the singer? Did that happen? Or is that just like one of those rock and roll myths?
Well, I have a vague recollection that I heard that somewhere, but I don't know if it's true. So I probably didn't hear it from a valid source. It was just like, you know, in the rumor mill.
Yeah, yeah.
But But yeah, so I when Garbage Man, I think Courtney would bring, I was doing a video and Courtney brought Dave Grohl to the production office. So I sort of met Dave before I met Courtney, and then I went to meet Courtney. Was opening for, God, maybe Primus or Smashing Pumpkins. They were playing a small gig in San Francisco. So I went up to talk to her about doing her video. She wasn't going out with Kurt at the time, but she introduced me to Kurt. It was a really weird thing. It was like Billy Corgan and...
Because she used to date Les. Billy as well, right?
Yeah. Yeah, it was a really strange triangle.
They're all just sort of hanging out and cross-pollinating. Is that how you met Billy as well, was through Courtney?
No, I actually met Billy years back through Janet Billig, who was working at Astroworks and Caroline Records.
Yeah.
This was Gish era, mm-hmm. right? So I shot, I did a live gig, New Year's Eve gig of the Pumpkins early on at the Metro in Chicago. So that ended up making it to a film. And then...
was that the video for I Am One?
Yeah, exactly.
When Billy had hair? There's loads of hair. See, those guys, the two videos you did with them, Cherub Rock as well, very psychedelic.
Yeah.
Lots of like, is the technique called dissolve when one shot goes into the other, into the other, into the other?
Yeah.
That was like a radical approach to music video making at that point, right? I don't recall seeing many other videos prior to that utilize that.
Cherub Rock.
Yeah. What's up, guys?
These are my dogs, Mufasa and Eloise.
Is that what this one's called, Mufasa?
Mufasa,
that's
yeah.
so good. It suits him.
They like to be a part of everything.
It must have been, I mean, editing a video like that must have taken you forever.
Cherub Rock took a, yeah, it's funny actually, that took a week. And that was one of the, hey.
Hey.
Outside. Sorry, guys.
It's all right. It adds to the ambiance. You've got to be quiet though, guys.
That was a Super 8 adventure where I had actually processed half of the film in my bathtub. So I'm just laughing because Mufasa's right behind me. it was really hard to actually edit that stuff just because it was dark. The image quality wasn't that great. So
he's he's got a squeaky toy.
Why don't you just grab that from him and he'll be safe.
Come on, boy.
Drop it. There you go. So and it's funny actually with Cherub Rock, even though it looks like that there's a lot of layers there, that's mostly actually just cut. They're straight images, but the image is so decayed that it looks like you're looking sometimes at two or three images at the same time. Most of the super densely layered things that I did were with Sonic Youth early on, the second video, yeah. Beauty Lies in the Eye, and the third, Candle, and then Come As You Are, obviously.
Yeah.
And probably Ride has, you know, that's pretty dense too. But that's like, it's funny, like I really love doing those things just because they're pretty dreamy.
And Pumpkins are a very dreamy sounding band, aren't they?
Yeah.
Were you telling me when we did the print interview that Billy wasn't happy with your work? There was a little bit of a disagreement over the creative direction of that, which seems crazy because I think it came out perfectly and served the song and the band and the image and their whole aesthetic perfectly. But then I guess Billy is he?
There's some layers there. I think that it's layers to the reaction. Oh, sorry, guys.
It's all good. Don't worry. Go on and don't come back.
I'll say. Go on. Good boy. So, but it's funny because Billy's reaction actually to the video was actually more about the weather that we shot in. We were shooting in San Francisco and it ended up being super rainy that night and we were in the forest. So it was cold, but they're from Chicago, you know, and you don't really get weather colder than that. So it was strange to hear objections to weather. Cause I don't have any control over that.
Control over it. Yeah.
But I think ultimately what, what that song is about is really trying to kick indie rock impulses in the teeth, you know, and you know, for the indie rockers that sort of wanted to be coddled and insulated and not really grow up, I guess, in Billy's eyes. So, the lyrically, it's a song about that takes a negative approach on something that I hold really dear, because it's like, I think there's so much amazing music that came out of that culture. So one of the things I did want to do at that point, which I don't think he got at the time, was to shoot in a format that was pure indie rock, pure, you know, alternative, which was Super 8, you know? And you can tell by the next videos that they did on that album that they wanted a lot more polish, you know. Cherub Rock was probably a little dirty.
Yeah. Well, obviously we have to talk about Nirvana. You did four videos with them, right? You did Slither as well.
Four.
Yeah. Which was the first that you shot, Come As You Are?
Yeah, we shot Come As You Are.
Come As You Are. Then
In Bloom.
In Bloom, then Lithium.
Then Lithium and then Slither.
And then Slither.
Yeah, and then Sliver. Yeah, and then we were doing a film, actually. We were doing a film that was supposed to be about sort of the Nirvana experience, you know, from the inside and out. And we were just sort of at that stage where it was sort of the outward look in, which was a lot of performance and things like that. And Kurt died right in the middle of that.
How did you come on board with them in such a close, intimate way? Because a lot of these other artists you've worked with once, maybe twice. Mm-hmm. Obviously, as we get to later on, there's bands like Rise Against and stuff where there's been several collaborations. But that early on, when they could have, I guess, worked with anyone and done different videos with different people, it seemed like you were their guy for an extended period of time there. Was it just a personal bond and closeness?
I think so. And I think, you know, that Nirvana was a funny... to be in that bubble... You know, and I'm. This is sort of like a third person perspective on Nirvana. You know, to be sort of, you know, literally living under a bridge, and all of a sudden having the world at your feet. You know, it is abrasive in so many ways. You know, I mean, it's rewarding, I'm sure, absolutely. But I also think that to get yanked out of that reality, so much, and then just to figure out how you actually create something, you know, that has that sort of genuine thing. So I think Kurt was really protective about who he worked with, you know, and to make sure that people knew that the Kurt before, right? And to be able to trust in
Go on, get out of there.
You want me to go just shut them out? Let me just do
that. Yeah, okay. Do you want me to do it if you want to show
me? No, I'll do it. Do you want to keep running?
Yeah, of course.
Sorry.
No, no worries.
You guys outside.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince.
Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Sorry about that. I should have done that early on.
No, it's all good. It's all good.
I didn't fuck you up too much.
No, it's fine. Honestly, I'm pretty loose with stuff like that. It all adds to the transparency of the conversation and the laid-back vibes. So, he had a very kind of trusting...
Yeah, but I also think that at how... with Smells, they didn't have a great experience on Smells Like Teen Spirit, I've been told. And
did that precede the videos you made?
Yeah, that was Smells Like Teen Spirit was the first video off the album. So when it came time to do the second one, they wanted to work with somebody that they just felt carry the same aesthetic, right? So when I met Kurt at that club in San Francisco, and I'd seen them tour quite a bit with Sonic Youth. They opened for Sonic Youth for several tours. He said to me, like right off the bat, basically, "You've done my favorite video in the world,"
which was
Holla, my first video for Mazzy Star. So I was like, it was pretty funny, just because you don't, when you meet people like that, typically the praise goes one way, right? And
it's outgoing.
Yes, exactly. So that was, you know, pretty disarming. And I also, then we just stopped, we connected, we talked for a long time, and it was just, you know, it felt like we had that sort of bond. So when it came time to award the video, Kurt said he wanted to work with me, and his only note to me was like, "I don't want to be in the video," right? And so, because he was on every newspaper cover, every magazine cover, you know, his image was ubiquitous. Actually, all of Nirvana's images, they were ubiquitous. So, and they were sick of themselves, basically sick of them seeing themselves. So, like, I knew that that's going to be an issue. I'm going to have to walk a line with that, because the record company's not going to like that. So, can I come up with something that honors both? That serves both masters, basically, right? So, you know, there's some images in that video that sort of obscure their identity.
How did you achieve that effect with the water dripping down in front of
them? That's just a shooting through a plexi, basically, with water coming down the, just like a sheet of water, you know, that had, and it's cool just because you know, you get all sorts of warps and things like that.
And so, it obviously links directly to the album cover.
Yeah.
And you've got references to the baby in it as well, and it nailed it. And was he happy with that? Then he was like,
"Yeah,
okay,
he was super happy." Yeah,
I'll be.
I got
in
asked
it,
back.
Yeah, and the next one, I mean, was In Bloom next? Yeah, that's when they sort of address the whole, I guess, theme of celebrity and fame and
originally,
send it up.
Yeah, and originally it wasn't that way. Originally, I came up with the idea that ultimately became part of Heart-Shaped Box, but it was really more about, you know, a kid growing up in a clan family and then seeing her family for what it was and pivoting out of it. And it wasn't super narrative. There was still a lot of abstract stuff, but, and there was like Wizard of Oz imagery in there and all that. But it was pretty poetic, but it was an ambitious idea, and the record company didn't have the time to actually develop that, you know, because it takes time to shoot and prep it and shoot it and all that stuff. So, the idea was to basically just do something off riffing off of Ed Sullivan and how we like our pop stars. And so, we just went down that road with tongue in cheek, and
which is kind of what the song is as well, isn't it? The song's kind of have it. Is the song having a go at perhaps people who've sort of jumped on board the alternative rock?
Oh, completely.
Bandwagon and
yeah. Well, also just likes the bands for all the wrong reasons.
Yeah.
Right. So, and a lot of that. It's funny too, because that it obviously showed up on the album. That made them popular, but they weren't super popular before, but it's almost like it anticipated that sort of fame in a way, which is prescient, you know.
Well, there's, I mean, the Velvet Revolver video, Fall to Pieces, we'll talk about that a little later on as well, and what that almost predicted is heartbreaking. But the final one in the Nevermind trilogy, Lithium, and did you just go on the road with the band to capture that? And what was that like at that point in time, being out on,
you know, that actually,
tour with Nirvana?
Yeah, that actually came out from, we harvested a lot of footage from different sources. So it, there were live shows that were shot all over the place, you know, and then it was just doing something that, or putting it together in a way that evoked, you know, what it was like to be, you know, at a, one of their shows, but also just, you know, pretty dreamy and just tripped out.
Yeah, hence all the dissolves and stuff again. And, yeah, the, and it does, it really captures, I never saw them live, but it really captures that live energy. Mm-hmm. And they must have been a very exhilarating band to watch.
Yeah.
From what I've heard and seen.
A lot of noise for three guys.
Do you know what I really enjoyed, actually, was watching the In Bloom video the other day and watching Dave Grohl in it. And you can see how much he's fully in character and in the zone. And obviously now he's known for being incredibly funny in all the Foo Fighters videos, but I guess you would have seen it firsthand from your point of view. Even then, there was a comedian there, wasn't there?
Completely, yeah. He was super hammy. Chris was too, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think those guys, everybody really, like, we did that video. That's four takes, totally. Two in suits and two in dresses. And so, and every single one of those takes, like, you could have just taken that take and released that as a video, you know.
But just as a one
just
shot.
Just as one
yeah.
shot, yeah. Yeah, they're all super funny.
And Slither is just in like a garage or something, is it? And you've got Frances Bean is at the start sort of having a little dance to the bass yeah. line.
Kurt's hand, she's, her back's to a cardboard, like a sheet of cardboard. And Kurt's actually behind the sheet. We punched a hole in the car. The
right.
car. So he's sort of like doing the puppet. He's the puppet master.
Oh, amazing.
Grabbing her back and like, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I thought she had some pretty good moves for such
yeah,
a young
exactly.
kid. I was like... got soul in her. So he was kind of
she had a handle
making
on her
a dance. That's amazing.
Yeah, that was shot in his garage again, super 8. That was just us four. Like I didn't have any help on that. It was just me lighting and like, say when I'm ready, I was like, hey guys, come down here. And then we just, you know, messed around for an hour or so and then kaboom.
Did you see the sort of the fame that he was exposed to? Did you see it change him?
It's funny. I had experiences that reflected it changing him, but when you were with him, it felt like he was still, you know, Kurt. I mean, obviously he had some issues with substance abuse, you know, but that was I also saw that early on. So I know that, you know, whenever anybody has those issues, it's always present in a way, you know, sometimes more, sometimes less. And you see the struggle against that. But I also did see Kurt really fought effortlessly to the eye to just be normal, you know, and not be that guy who
yeah.
is like, who became famous. And so, you know, he's really down to earth and you know, super normal in a way. And you know, but there was a war going on, obviously. And but he tried to, you know, he knew who he wanted to win that war. But it just ended up being more powerful.
Did you notice a similar struggle with Chris early on with Soundgarden? Because that news for me was so shocking, because he always seemed like someone who was, he obviously had pain within him because he'd sung about it and he touched on those surfaces so convincingly, and that obviously came from a very real place, but he always seemed to kind of have it together from the outside looking in. And I'd seen him play just maybe 3 or 4 months before doing like a solo acoustic gig, and he just was like effortlessly charming and...
Yeah. Yeah, Chris was a, you know, he was so talented in a way that I don't feel like, I mean, there are very few people that have the command of, you know, all the forces like he did, you know. I mean, there are amazing artists that are just so explosive on stage and they sort of like do one thing or a couple things really, really well. Chris was an amazing guitarist. He was an amazing singer. He was obviously, you know, born to be a front man just with the look. So he had all those things. But the thing that impressed me more about Chris than any of those elements was actually, he was super funny, but he was a poet. And his lyrics, like, I feel like they can stand shoulder to shoulder with any poet, especially in this age, but also even eons going back. And so as a lyricist and what that was evocative was just an intellect that was so dialed into the poetic nature of different experiences. So it's funny, like, I don't, like, he's sort of like, if you look at the rock guys, like, he's the Renaissance dude, you know. He's the guy that had all of those qualities. And I never, ever sensed that sort of need for a way out like that, you know. It was shocking to me too. It's still shocking. Like, it would be like, I bad luck to actually name anybody who is still alive, but it would just be like, you know, pick your the most solid rock star who you would never expect that from, and that's what happens. And it's just like, you can't process it. So it's weird. It's and I think what's also weird is because there has been this string of suicides. You know, there was a certain point after Chester, especially, actually, yeah, Chester and Scott, that it felt like, man, this is becoming the normal way to die. You know, it's not natural death. It's not, you know, it's not by accident or anything like that. It's like opting out. And it's the thing that hurts so much about it when people do that is just it hurts to think that somebody was in that much pain that death is the only answer. And what do you do with that, you know?
There's been, we'll lighten up the subject in a minute, but there's been an awful lot of death, particularly with people you work with. Does that leave a mark on you? Do you find it hard sometimes to deal with that? Because, you know, you've got Kurt, you've obviously got Scott, you've got Chris, even people who you work with, say, once, like a Prince, and mm-hmm. I definitely want to talk to you about that video mm-hmm. and working with him, but, and obviously DJ AM, and, I mean, do these things leave a mark on your soul?
Yeah, when you look at, let's say the artists that I'm attracted to are, they have a dark side, right? And obviously my work has a dark side too, but I don't obsess on it. And I feel like those artists don't obsess on it. But I think that the pernicious nature of that darkness, you know, I guess it's logical that that's going to overtake everything else. You'd hope that it doesn't, but I think that you know, nature can be grotesque and can smother and choke and just, you know, beat up you know, the people and that in a way that it's just so relentless. And I think that when you add substance abuse into it, which seems to get people's guards down,
yeah,
even if
and always seems to be involved, doesn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah. And it's weird because, like, I have, like, I'm not, I don't have any of those impulses, you know? It's probably just, I'm lucky that my body chemistry does not like opiates. Like, it has a horrible reaction to it. And it just it just turns out to be the golden elixir for some people who are super talented, and it gets the better of them.
Would you say, sorry, that you worked with Scott more than anyone else? Did you do more videos with him?
Probably, yeah.
Than anyone else? Because you did Interstate Love Song and Vaseline for Stone Temple Pilots.
A couple others, actually. Days of the Week. And I thought there was another one in there, too. Well, there's a couple live shows. And another, there's a, I don't know where it is, but there actually is the very first Interstate Love Song that we did was an experiment. That was super cool. It was a live performance in Chicago in an old room. And we ended up basically just doing the other one that was ultimately shown on MTV. But I'm actually searching for where that is. But then I also Scott had a side band called Magnificent Bastards.
I thought you were going to say a side band called Velvet Revolver.
Yeah, exactly. I've heard of it. Sort of a side band. And then obviously, yeah, Velvet Revolver.
So you're probably around 7 or 8 projects together in total.
Yeah.
And was the relationship there one of purely creative understanding, or was there a personal friendship and a mutual admiration and respect there as well?
Both, yeah. Yeah. Both. I mean, I it's not dissimilar to my relationship with Kurt, to be honest.
Right.
Where there was a trust, and it was born early on in their careers. So, and as they became more popular, obviously they they're looking for normalcy.
Yeah.
I think it's something that you seek out when you're in that place, that it's like, you need something that you can trust and something that you know, and is not going to have the surprises and even deceptions actually that come sometimes with people that are working with you later on.
The partnership of Vaseline and Interstate, like, they almost seem like companion pieces to me, mm-hmm. stylistically. And what was the decision with the kind of guy with the long nose running around town? What's that representing, that metaphor?
That's Pinocchio.
Right.
So I can't remember the exact lyrics, but the theme of Interstate Love Song is it concerns lying. So it was just, somebody tells a fib early on in the video, and throughout the video, their nose gets longer and longer and longer. And then finally it's a foot long.
Who's got the foot long? Were you one of the first people to find out about Velvet Revolver then?
Yeah, I know. Well, I mean, other than the label, obviously.
But, yeah.
Scott called and said he's got a new project, and would I be interested in doing a video for him.
And then he said, and the other members are diddle diddle dur, and you went, where do I sign? And you based it on a catacomb style party, right?
Yeah.
Tell me about the video shoot for that. Was it all done in France?
No,
in Paris?
We actually built it.
Okay.
Scott couldn't go out of the country. I don't think he could even leave the city. He was dealing with some legal issues. So there were some restraints on him, but the whole idea was to bring to life in Paris, there are these catacombs that exist underground, deep underground, miles and miles of them. And some of them store bones that are dug up from other cemeteries and sort of curated to be in a very, very artful, display. So, but for me also, it was like Slither was really about the if you're going to say there's a theme about it, it's sort of like going to that primordial spot where, you know, your love of music and your love of creating music and the people that you connect to is it's that sort of primal element of rock and roll that so let's just put them. I mean, obviously, these guys are all rock gods, you know.
Rock gods, I was going to say. Yeah, they are larger than life stars. And maybe the last huge rock band to come through. Like, I can't really think of any or many, apart from maybe Queen of the Stone Age, but they were, like, huge, weren't they? I mean, well, obviously, because Guns N' Roses is basically the band with Scott, and he was huge in his own right.
Yeah.
He put them together, and it's
crazy. And I think all the instincts for if you're gonna do any videos for them, it's sort of like, well, yeah, how can you deify them even more, you know? And because all the Guns N' Roses videos are so bombastic, and it's just like, oh my God, it's just like I can't stand that aesthetic, right?
You didn't want to put Slash outside a church soloing for 8 minutes.
Yeah. So all of my thoughts were just like, okay, well, let's just go underground. Let's go to the spot. Instead of doing that, let's go underground and let's have them connect to something that's much more primal about what would even pull you to as a band together to make stuff, you know, and it's like not having it, you know, anything that is evocative of like a calculation, like a business calculation, you know. It's an entrepreneurial venture to get together as, you know, the biggest guys on the planet.
Make some serious cheddar.
Yeah. And so, so we had to deal with these legal problems with Scott was dealing. So it's like, well, how do you create the Paris Catacombs in Los Angeles? So you turn to Hollywood. Right. And we just made the catacombs and got Scott, you know, when he was available to us. And
he really looks like a combination of Iggy Pop, David Bowie, Mick Jagger. He's kind of channeling all the rock greats, isn't he, in that?
Little Peter Murphy.
Yes. And he's just, I mean, what a fucking rock star he was.
Yeah. It's funny, too, like you say that, because when you saw Velvet Revolver live, Scott would have two songs that were sort of Bowie, two songs that were sort of Iggy, you know, a little Brian Ferry in there, some Peter Murphy. It's like, it's almost like he channeled those guys for like one or two songs each. And his voice was like, it was head to toe, right? And even vocally. So, it was, and Jagger obviously. So, yeah, it's funny that you say that, because that was like when you're seeing the shows, it's like that's Bowie and that's Jagger, and he had all the moves, but he did them better than the originals.
He's one of the few guys to be able to get away with those t-shirts that finish like above your belly button. That's a hard look to pull off and make look sexy, isn't it?
Yeah,
and he did it. And the Fall to Pieces video, I mean, have you seen that recently?
No.
Have you seen it since he passed?
No.
It's so heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Like it almost seems to foresee that. And how brave of him to expose and represent himself in his own band, in his own video in that way.
Yeah.
Did he discuss the idea to do that with you? Was it his idea? Was it a mutual collaborative idea? How did that
Done Slither, and then I was traveling with them. We were doing a couple shows, live shows. And we started talking about, you know, he called me into the dressing room and says, the next song I want to do is Fall to Pieces. And it's about my struggle. And I want to be honest about it. And he just said, you're the guy to do it because you were there basically with, you know, you saw the ups and downs and all that. So, at that point, you just have to be faithful to that mission, you know, and you know, really sort of strip it down, and you know, a lot of the loneliness, and the unreliability that you know, a problem like that sort of delivers to you know, the various walks of life, you know, whether it's your marriage, your band, even yourself, you know. And then also the counterpoint of that is like, you know, when you crack it and you have the, you know, those sort of flourishes of genius, you know, so it's sort of like making sure that it basically covered both sides of that coin. And, but it was raw. Scott, you know, he lived a lot of those moments over again when we were shooting. We shot here, actually, a lot of it.
In the house?
In the house, yeah.
So the scenes when he's like in the room on his own, that's right.
Yeah, and then we shot some stuff out on the beach out in Santa Monica. So, and his wife, Mary, was in it.
Wow, that is really real.
Yeah, he was...
That's so rare, isn't it, in this day and age, to see that level of fearlessness and honesty and artistry.
Yeah. Yeah, it was brave. And even like journaling, like, because there's a lot of stuff and there's a lot of stuff that doesn't end up in a video that you like, oh, here's an idea and here's something that I was when you know, he used to write a lot, and so I asked him to do a journal leading up to the video, you know, that we can show in the video, show some of the writing and even put photos and things like that in there. So he took that very seriously. Like he came with a journal.
Like a method actor almost.
Completely, yeah. He came with a journal that was, had a lot of pages filled with stuff. You know, it took a lot of time. So yeah, it's gotta be hard for him just cause you're rehashing stuff. You know, it's like, and part of it's also romantic, you know, it's like, wow, this is, I was doing this stuff at a moment in time and it resulted in some great music. You know, what does that do with your head? You know, at a certain point. So like it starts, you start to undercut your own message at a certain point, but he just felt that it was something that he needed to do. So.
What drew you to the DJ AM documentary idea? Was he an old friend of yours? Was he someone that you knew?
I shot him. For years I did all the branding and the video and film work for Insomniac Events, which is like Electric Daisy Carnival and Nocturnal Wonderland and all those sort of EDM festivals. And then also hard events where AM played both. So he did EDC a couple months before he died. And then after the plane crash that he survived, his first real commercial gig was at Hard Halloween. So I shot both events. And obviously I knew him. I'd seen him earlier at different clubs, but you know, just met him backstage. Never really friends. But honestly, one of the incentives for doing the film was having lost a lot of people to that cocktail, the deadly cocktail of fame and substance abuse, and self-doubt, insecurities. And I don't know who it was, but somebody died. I know somebody else that I remember knowing. And it's like, God, this story, it keeps happening. It keeps happening. And nobody's learning from it before. And I also think that a lot of the things that you see, my experience, when people have those sorts of issues, you know, the people that are in a position to actually protect that person, even from themselves, and lead them into on a better path, you know, whether it's sobriety or you know, it's sort of minimizing the dangers around them, whatever it is, but when people die, it's always in the news. It's like those people are always alone. Like they don't, there's no mention about anything around them that could have been done differently and possibly saved them or extended their lives. You know, it's like sometimes you never know. Like that just may, I mean, I always felt like Scott had a target on his back, you know, and it was just a matter of time. I mean, he was probably the most fragile of all these guys. But, and one of the, I had been asked to do a doc on AM before, like maybe a year before I finally said yes. And the thing that I finally said yes to was, or the reason why I finally said yes was like, okay, this story has got to stop happening because they're all cookie cutter stories. Like you can interchange any one of those names. And so I went back to the family who had asked me to make the doc. And I said,
they'd specifically asked you, had they?
Yeah. And I said, all right, I'm 100% in if the movie is about this. It's about all the it's truthful about AM's life in terms of like where those problems came from. what he was wrestling with. You know, it's not a puff piece. I mean, he's an amazing talent and a really an amazing guy, but you know, you're not serving the lesson of his death, even of his life, to be honest, if you're going to be, if you're going to, you know, not deal with this, the real substance of his life. And so I said, if I can be 100% truthful about that, and we can set it, set the film within the continuum of all the various artists that have, I mean, and going back to Elvis and Michael Jackson, like all these, you know, guys that sort of wrestled with those issues. If the story can be that truthful, then I'm in, all in. And so so they said, the mother said, yeah, that's the film that needs to be made. And so yeah, we launched in right away.
And there's obviously so many. I mean, is Travis Barker's not in it, is he?
No,
he's not interviewed. Did you approach him?
Yeah.
He just didn't feel like it was painful.
Yeah, just something didn't. It probably just wasn't time, you know. Since then, he's talked on certain things, and I've worked with Trav on different projects. Like I did a Psycho White video, and we were even talking about doing something with the transplants, but. He works a lot with Tim Armstrong, who I partner with quite a bit, and so yeah, it just felt like maybe a little too personal, or he wanted to save the story for himself. He's the last surviving member, or last survivor, sorry, of the plane crash, you know. So, and when you know the interview's going to go there, I'm sure that's not very comforting, you know. So
who says about when the two of them are just on the street trying to put each other out,
mm-hmm.
and that's when it really hits home, like the severity and the who is it who says that in the interview?
That's he's a first responder.
Okay,
actually,
so he's just like a guy who's
a police,
there.
No,
a policeman.
Police help. Yeah, who got the call, and yeah. When he came over the hill and saw the plane on fire, it was fully engulfed at that point. So, and you can hear the dash cam video and audio. You can hear Travis and AM talking to him. Haunting. And, when I did research where, you know, you can see like a bit of that, you can find that on YouTube. And then I tracked down I found the police force and basically flew out there to meet him, and he pulled out the entire dash cam. So, which is from the moment he gets the call and then is racing like 100 miles per hour through the streets, which is what opens the film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know whether it's just because I'm not really in that world, but I didn't really know anything about his story. Mm-hmm. Coming from the UK, I don't know whether he translated as much over here.
Not so much.
But what an inspiring guy.
Yeah.
And just the level of generosity in his character. The dog's still going.
Is that all right?
Yeah, it's fine. Okay. Doesn't matter. It's all ambiance. I'm just worried that they're laying into some poor human on
it's
the street.
It's just a neighbor.
It is. There they go again. And yeah, what a special, generous, selfless, caring, sweet, real guy. And what a sad loss.
Sad loss, yeah. I mean, he was larger than life. And he crammed so much life into every second, and it's the same thing. It's like it's the not necessarily irony, but the paradox of somebody who is so committed and so generous with his self, and helping people.
Yeah.
And then you know suffering from so much self doubt and insecurity, and all nurtured along by. You know, some pharmaceuticals that were prescribed that really erode your sense of self and self-worth and just get your guard down, you know? And so here's the complex sort of elements that fed into his death, you know, there's a lesson to be learned on every front in terms of, you know, taking care of yourself, for doctors, you know, over prescribing meds that are,
well, the same thing got Prince, right?
Mm-hmm.
As well. It seems to be a real problem in America, doesn't it?
Yeah. You don't see that in the UK so much, right?
No.
Europe?
It's not like a pill-popping culture,
right,
at all, really. And you can't really get anything, excuse me, you can't really get anything legally of that nature, really, unless you are seriously, seriously sick. But it seems to just be so readily and widely available out here.
You can also, if you're in a position to actually tell the doctor what you want, you know, and to not have the doctor say no, but you're pretty much prescribing yourself,
mm-hmm,
drugs that you want, you know, for one reason or another, you know, whether it's because you're just, you know, you crave them or you need them, or, you know, somebody told you that they're going to help. So yeah, it's dark.
How did the, put me in the kind of the whirlwind of, so in the late 80s, you're sort of making Super 8 videos experimentally with Sonic Youth. And then as early as, was it like 92, you're with Prince, 93? And you're on this huge, big budget, like, movie shoot for My Name is Prince.
Yeah, it's funny.
That's a rapid growth, isn't it? And did you ever stop at that moment and look around and go, oh, this is going all right, isn't it?
Yeah.
Things are going well.
It's funny, like that at that point, it was sort of like, because I was working with REM at that point too, and you know,
I love that video too.
Just bands that like are like, I'm not even thinking about like the material thing. I just love their music, and it was such a, I was so lucky to be able to work with people, you know, who made such amazing music, you know, and it's funny. Yeah, it was just it was nonstop in terms of like,
when you factor in edit time. Yeah, it's like, how many were you doing a year? Did you have like an average sort of number?
I was probably doing like 3 to 5 a month.
3 to 5 a month.
Yeah, and I even on some jobs like Prince, I had to jump off early to do REM. So that video is sort of like an exquisite corpse in a way. There's a few different directors that did different stages.
Okay.
Prince had a funny way of working where it's sort of like, you know, things got piecemealed together, and he's very, very idiosyncratic in terms of how he approaches stuff. And you know, even just like he would have musicians on call, and it's like at 2 a.m. He's like, come on in, let's go to the studio, and they'd be in there till noon. But it was like, it was all that sort of like, however, you know, whenever the mood moves me, you know, we'll be doing stuff. So yeah, but Prince was there's a whole aura. He's sort of like the Good Witch in a way, like the bubble who floats down in the bubble, you know, and it's like he everything's pretty sparkly, and
yeah,
and but at the same time he's super humble and very approachable, very smart, methodical. He wanted you know, paper edit. I'm very impulsive, and so it's like, if I'm gonna work in a studio or an edit or even writing, it's like I don't necessarily prep. I prep my consciousness in terms
of, you know, storyboarding every scene, yeah.
But I don't sort of do a, okay, this is my to-do list, you know, going in there. It's like I just want to go and let the movement let wherever my taste sort of lead me. And he wanted to do a paper edit before I even arrive in the edit every day. Like, he wanted to have a paper edit. I was like, I don't work that way. And we, it's funny, we had a little altercation about that, and then it was like acrimonious for a day, and then we made our peace the next day and trusted in each other's working methods. So but yeah, then I was supposed to travel with him to Egypt to do a show. We're going to go all around the world. And then something happened where the tour basically got sidetracked. And then I ended up basically just doing all these other videos. So we never got back to. I don't know if he ever actually even went there, but that was the original plan, was to do a whole year, like a doc on his life. And
so that's two missed opportunities on the documentary front, right? With Nirvana and Prince. Fuck.
Yeah, and that one just never even got out of the gate. I think the stuff with Nirvana was pretty gross, actually, because it's like the film wasn't even a fraction of the way done. And when he died, it's sort of like, okay, well, how do we get this out there? That was sort of like the people who were, you know, the business side of that world, they're like, let's get it out there. And I was like, oh man, that's just so gross.
Straight away.
My thinking that it's straight away, there might have been a little gap, you know.
But certainly.
But it was too close anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's that noise now?
Refrigerator.
Is it?
Is it? It's not going to fuck you up.
Is it ramped up?
No, it just goes every now and then.
Let's bring it home with the Joan Jett documentary, Bad Reputation. Did you need some lightness for the soul after the AM project? Did you need to do something with a little bit more of an inspirational, upbeat message? And because Joan, again, I didn't quite realize, I've always been a huge fan of her, not just the music, but everything she represents. But I didn't realize how bigoted people were towards the Runaways just because they were girls playing rock music. I had no idea they faced that much animosity and hatred from the American media, and it's crazy.
It's nuts. I didn't know that either, to be honest. That was a shocker. And I think that, you know, she's such a badass, and she can hold her own with any man on stage. So like, you don't even look at her in gender terms.
No.
You know, she's just like, you know, because in the same way that you don't look at men in gender terms.
Yeah.
It's like, they're just he's Jimmy Page, a badass
rock and roller.
Yeah. And you know, and on through all your, so it was horrifying to actually go back and track her through forming a band, which, you know, you got a little resistance there, but you know, finding Kindred Spirits and forming the Runaways, and then yeah, like when it's you know, everybody thought, well, this is sort of like cartoon level, but when they realized that they were serious, not just Joan, but everybody else in the band, yeah, they started to get a lot of shit and violent too. So, you know, just because girls wanted to play rock and roll, it was like,
she said
it was,
she had a car battery thrown at her.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it was a violent opposition to girls just playing music. And it's like, as a man, of course, we're all familiar with how difficult it is for women to make their way in a man's world, whether it's the music industry or politics or whatever. But I think that, and I even sort of considered myself like pretty dialed into that, but to actually learn that on a daily basis, all the shit that they get, and it's 4 years, decades, she's still getting it. So
yeah, it's not just shit, is it? It's like hatred, like total
venomous, yeah,
poison,
yeah, and even record companies actively working against their success, you know, when their job obviously is, that's not part of the job description, you know, it's supposed to be the opposite. And so, yeah, it's a control factor. And I think that right now, especially in this day and age where, you know, you've got a guy who's, you know, who proudly actually cops to that sort of behavior.
Who's that?
What's his name? So, and a whole movement that is reacting to it.
Was all of that going on whilst you were editing the film?
Yeah. Yeah.
That must have felt so timely.
The Me Too movement actually sort of popped towards the tail end of the edit. I mean, obviously, parity and equality—they're always they're always on the on the table in terms of issues.
But it's like omnipresent at the moment, isn't it?
But I think that that obviously sort of turbocharged things.
It must have felt like you were making something even more vital than you thought you already had.
Yeah, yeah.
And did it help with the release of the film?
I don't. It's funny. I don't know. I mean, I'm Magnolia picked up the movie, and they're they've got such a strong history of actually supporting independent film, and intelligent films. Like they did the Ruth Bader Ginsburg doc as well, and a whole bunch of others. So, I think that it wasn't like, oh, this is like trendy, you know. It felt like they were in it for the right reasons, and I think that. So that was rewarding. I think it was an honorable pickup, basically. In a way.
And it's, you know, it's a story that I can't believe hadn't already been told in such a way. Because she's like Lemmy to me. She's like one of those like pilots of rock and roll.
Yeah.
That's just been such a fighter, and such, as you say, a badass. I couldn't believe no one had done one. Had there been one at all?
No. Well, they'd done a Runaways. They'd
done a Runaways film.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
So. That had been done, but that's, I mean, Joan was out of that band when she was 19 or 20, so you know that's a very short time.
That's like the introduction chapter, isn't it?
Pretty much, right? So, and it is actually in the movie; it's the first act. So, and act two and three are, you know, there's a lot of stuff in there that and I think that, you know, not only her musical career but also her work. Outside of music, in terms of like her, being an instrument for change herself, you know, on the planet and on behalf of underdogs and people who don't have a voice.
Yeah, it's not even just a gender thing, is it? It is just anyone who's basically kind of been spat on and trampled on and overlooked and disrespected, marginalized.
Yeah, and just, you know. Human rights, animal rights, even work in the environment. You know, she's been very active in the name of just sort of bettering life on the planet. And so...
We need more of them.
It's funny, too, because she's so humble about it. You know, she's not beating on her chest. She's not, you know... doing selfies of herself in, you know, with other people or at an issue related event. You know, she just goes in there and she does the work and so I think that her posture in those things, it has a, there's an integrity about her activism that I think is really, refreshing, and because the nobility of it actually shines through, because she's not cheapening it with a selfie, basically.
And you got some great guests in it, dude. There's some amazing guests in there, like a wide pool of. When you are making a film like that, do you go through your own personal phone book? Do you sort of go at the angle from the agent manager side, because there's such a broad scope of people, from Billy Joe to Debbie Harry to
Nikki Haley,
everyone's
Iggy
in there.
Pop.
Iggy, yeah. Where did you film that? At his house?
Shot his house in Miami. Yeah. I mean, I'd done a video for him before, but I think, yeah, it's like, you know, look, there's six ways to Sunday, right? And I think that
I'm really just trying to steal tips from you for my podcast as to how to go about getting these cool people on the show.
Yeah. You hit them from all angles, basically. But I think that the whole thing with the film like that is like, okay, well, who's in their life and who can actually speak about their life in a way that has the authenticity, but the authority, I guess.
And the insight.
Yeah. Yeah. And so we were lucky that all those people, you know, Joan made it easy. You know, all this, like, when you say you're doing a film on Joan Jett, like, everybody, they want to step up, say their piece.
Final question, or maybe penultimate question, because it might be a weird one. Was Kim Fowley a wrong dude?
You know,
because you kind of obviously it's not about the Runaways as such. It's not about him, but you know, you hear so many stories about that guy. He was obviously an eccentric and a, you know, a special character.
Yeah.
But it seemed like he kind of maybe fucked up their career a bit as well, didn't he? And maybe fucked with certain people's minds a bit.
You know, it's hard to tell actually, because I have heard stories that are diametrically opposed from each other about their experiences with Kim Fowley. You know, you hear the stuff. I mean, Joan and even Cherie, they had great experiences with him. They had you know, artistically very rewarding and rich. And then you hear stories about things that may have gone on that you know, I looked deep into those stories just to see if there was something that actually needed to be in the film. And,
or something that would make you just not want to have him perhaps in the film too much at all.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you still got to tell the truth.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And I didn't, what I found anyway, and maybe that's because I didn't talk to the right people, or certain people didn't come forward with things. But I think that I didn't find enough evidence to allow me to say something about him that was quite possibly untrue.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, I'm not going to do the sensationalist thing.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And even though certain people sort of wanted that. But it's like, I didn't hear anything that actually... was that gave me that conviction, to be honest. And I can't put anything in the film that I don't believe in.
So he was obviously just, I mean, one thing we can definitely say is that he was a unique individual.
Oh my God, yes.
Wasn't he? Like a total freak, and a really important figure in the history of music and the history of freak alternative culture. And Rodney Bingheimer, man, like what an absolute LA legend that guy is. He's in it in a tiny snippet, right? Is it just like a very short, brief?
Yeah, and then there's some audio interviews that he did with the Runaways.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, they're both super eccentric. I mean, look, LA in the 70s was just bananas. You know, the drug culture, the club culture, the decadence. It was like, it was everything goes. And they were right in the pocket.
Yeah. Throw in the host in the parties, yep. Weren't they?
Yep. So, but yeah, Kim also was like, he's funny. The songs that he wrote, you know, they're coming to take me away. Aha, ho, wee, hee, to the funny farm. He wrote that song and a bunch of other, he was crafty. He was crafty. And I think, you know, colorful character. But,
and a product of the time and the environment, as you say.
Yeah, but maybe, you know, he's served his purpose with the Runaways, and maybe didn't. That band may have failed because it was mismanaged, but I also think when you're, you know, 19, 20 years old, and Jones said this to me, it's like, you can't really be calling yourself the Runaways anymore.
Yeah.
You know, because now you're an adult.
Well, it's something like the Sex Pistols. You know, some bands are meant to just burn bright for a very short period of time, and then that's it.
Yeah.
Because punk rock of that sort is a youth music, isn't it?
Completely.
And I don't know whether I'd want to go see a bunch of 50-year-olds called the Sex Pistols. Do you know what I mean? Remember it as it was.
But you can.
Yeah.
Now. sort of sad.
It is, right? Guns N' Roses. So my final question, Kevin, is you seem to be on a bit of a roll at the moment with these documentaries. Is there another one in the works at the moment? Have you got any subjects that are, you know, presenting themselves to you as things that you'd like to maybe explore at this stage? Can we reveal anything about future plans? Or
I am doing a Jane's Addiction doc.
Are you really?
Yeah.
Fuck.
So we're just...
Talk about decadent LA rock and roll.
Yeah. We're just in the very early stages of that. But yeah, super exciting. I mean, I saw them also in, you know, LA Club Days.
Yeah.
So, which was right around the time they actually just first released their live.
Live at the Roxy.
No, it's the Jane Says, basically. Yeah. So, So all those shows, and just LA at that point in the mid 80s, it was dark. And I think that the sort of gorgeous psychedelic flower that bloomed when they came out, you know, and with all its ferocity and danger and you know, really, they're out there. So I think it's a film that's focused on their first 5 years, you know.
Without that band in that time, alternative rock would have been a completely different movement, wouldn't it? They, for me, were the people that pushed down the gates and ushered that whole era in.
Completely. Without them, there is no Nirvana.
Or Rage Against the Machine.
So they you know, they sort of married so many different music genres together that it was and it was so explosive. And so the film goes up through the end of the first Lollapalooza when the band actually broke up. But like, there were fistfights on stage, you know, when they were playing that year, and it was pretty acrimonious. But still, you know, great. That's the Icarus part of the story, where they flew too close to the sun. But I think that, you know, there, it was a pretty gorgeous flight getting there.
They're a gorgeous band.
Yeah.
Well, I'm very excited about that. If people want to check out your work, it's just kevinkerslake.com, right? Is that the place
Precisely,
to go?
Precisely, yes.
Yeah. And yeah. You've got a YouTube page, I know. Is all your music video work on the YouTube page, or just is it getting there bit by
it's
bit?
It's getting there bit by bit. Like, I'm just finding stuff.
Because you're old
actually.
School, aren't you? Yeah. From the analog age.
Exactly. I just started actually. There's a playlist on there where I actually track down the label versions,
yeah,
right, of the releases, like, because every now and then there was a director's cut that you can see on my website, but there's a lot of work either on the website or on the YouTube channel.
Love it.
Yeah,
thank you so much for having me over to your house.
Thank you.
I know,
sir.
You've been under the weather, so I appreciate you taking the time and talking to me today.
Oh, good. No, I'm glad you made it out here.
You're feeling strong?
Oh yeah,
totally. Yeah. Awesome. All right, let's get those dogs inside.
Yeah.
On a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.